I think for me, hunting, working to provide life, taking life, providing meat for your family, we're really into the venison or whatever game we harvest, is a true reflection of life. There are many things to do this, but hunting or planting a food plot, you put something that looks like a dead item, a seed in the ground, and it comes to life and provides bounty for other critters to benefit on. All these things, I think, are reflections of how we should live life. And to the point, my oldest daughter, who now works for SpaceX, obviously very technical, her name is Raleigh. That's old English for dweller by the deer meadow. My youngest daughter is Ray, R-A-E, works for a very high-end defense company, kind of secretive, making drones. R-A-E, Ray, is Hebrew for doe. That's how much deer impact everything in my family.
There are people who hunt deer, and then there are those who understand them. For decades, Dr. Grant Woods has walked that line between hunter and scientist. Part biologist, part storyteller, studying whitetails with the kind of curiosity that never fades. From the rolling hills of the Ozarks to the screens of Growing Deer TV, he's turned science into strategy and passion into purpose. But behind every study and every hunt, there's something deeper. A belief that conservation and faith go hand in hand. That great hunts aren't just about the harvest, but about what we learn in the process. And through it all, one name has followed that same tradition of trust and precision: Winchester. For years, Dr. Grant Woods has relied on Winchester ammunition, not just as a product, but as a partner in the pursuit of better hunting, better understanding, and better stewardship of the land. Today we sit down with the man behind the data, the stories, and the passion that continues to shape how we think about deer in the wild places they call home. This is Winchester Life, and our guest today is Dr. Grant Woods. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. Through insider access to industry pioneers, first-hand looks at cutting-edge tech advancements, and the stories behind the scenes that have shaped the world of shooting sports and hunting as we know it, we'll dive into the sacred places like deer camps and duck blinds, talk about innovation and shooting tips with the world's best, while revisiting age-old traditions of hunting and shooting still alive in our country. I'm your host, Jason Brown, and welcome to the show. The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Repeating Arms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Folds of Honor, Birchwood Casey, Walkers, Winchester Pet, and Winchester Optics. Well, with us today is Dr. Grant Woods. First of all, thanks. I know you're probably... I absolutely know you're very busy right now in the whitetail woods, and it's what we all do this time of year, but how's your fall been going?
You know, good. I'm actually early archery season using a long bow and was able to take a doe with my stick bow, and I was excited as a, you know, that first deer. It was fun. So yeah, doing good. Having a good time, loving these little cold fronts coming in October.
Oh man, well thanks for joining us. Yeah, the cold front thing, I feel like we had a super dry, at least up here in Michigan, it's been super dry all summer, even into this early fall. So we've had rain for the last 3 or 4 days. We needed it bad. And cold front, I know a lot of deer are hitting the ground here in the last week, so it's kind of good to see. I think in the industry, the outdoor industry, it's a unique place. There's really nothing like it. But before that, before you were, you know, Growing Deer TV, what got you into the outdoors? What was the one thing when you were little, what shaped your passion for the outdoors and hunting specifically?
Yeah, I had a real clear story. I was in first grade, 6 years old, raised on a little 100-acre farm. You know, I'm 64, so back then you had a few pigs, few cows, a lot of weeds and a few crops in there. It was great wildlife habitat, although we didn't know it at the time, right? Yeah. And I had a little rabbit trap line. You'd take old scrap barn wood, build box traps, and I had to do my chores with the cows. And go run my trap line for school, and I had heard, and I don't remember this part of the story, I wish I knew where, but they're going to restock deer in the county. I'm from southern Missouri, and there were no deer. Deer were gone. Yep. And I found a female fawn, that cold, a little bit of snow morning, that had been shot by a poacher in one of our fields. And ever since that moment, I've just loved deer. I guess you might say at that time, I fantasized about deer. My dad and I drug it up to the pig house, and we skinned it out. Had no idea what we were doing. We rubbed it down with Epsom salt, thought we were tanning it. It was stiff as a piece of plywood, you know.
Yeah.
Nailed it up in the barn, and when I go do chores, I'd rub that hide, just think, man, maybe someday I'll see a deer. Didn't even think about hunting them, you know, see a real live deer out there. And so at my age, young boys, they want to be firemen, policemen, honorable professions. I just want to work with deer. There wasn't a term deer biologist that I'm aware of. I just want to work with deer and followed that passion, that inspiration, you might say, through, just kept chasing that and finding ways to wiggle between the cracks and get to work with deer. And here I am.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's funny how things that early shape you. And you, at the time, like you said, you didn't realize that. But those are the things in life that when you're little, that it kind of builds on throughout as you get older. So, you know, at 6 years old, that happened. How did that, what was the next step? Did you just, as a hunter, was there what was the switch that switched it for you?
You know, my dad, my grandfather, my uncle, my brother-in-law were all hunters. We rabbit hunted and quail hunted. That was a game, you know, around there.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a young boy, I was literally the sack toter. I'd carry the sack behind my dad to put the quail and rabbits in. And then I got a little bit bigger, and I was the bird dog. They'd send me into the brushy fence rows to flush them out, you know.
Sure.
Then I got that first single-shot 410 shotgun, could remember it clearly. And long before I ever thought about the industry at all, I remember one Christmas I got a box of Super X 410 shells.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, that big X on the box, just, man, I thought I was one of the men now. I got my own box of shells, you know. And
So
just that upbringing and that family, I was blessed to have a great family. And again, we lived on a little farm, so a lot of weeds, so we had a lot of rabbits and quail. Just that culture of we're not a family of great means.
Yeah.
So the men worked 6 days a week, and after church we went hunting. That's just what we did. And so I just never knew any different. And it was a great life. I have zero regret. I mean, it was so fun. You're with your family and those older men that are your mentors and setting a good example and caring for you. You know how it is. They pick on you, and they pick on you because they care for you.
Sure.
So, yeah, it was kind of idyllic childhood, I guess.
Yeah. And that's part of it. I think that's, if there's any path to the outdoors for anybody in their youth, it's having those great memories when they're little. It's being the bird dog in the piles of brush. It's helping track a deer before you can actually hunt yourself. Those are the things that shape young people. And I think, you know, you don't realize it, and you just bring them along, and then they turn into, you know, somebody that, you know, down the road, I mean, deer management, habitat, all that stuff that you do now, at what point did you realize, like, I want to take what I know and I want to apply it to deer management and habitat science and all this stuff. At what point did you think this could be a path for me?
Yeah, again, I don't think there were any careers like that. I knew I wanted to work a deer. I thought that meant going to college. So I went to the local college. First guy in my family to go to college, so I didn't know about, you know, University of Georgia or Mississippi State, those great deer schools at the time. And a typical country boy with a good family goes to the quote-unquote big city. It wasn't a big city, big for me. And got in a little trouble and messed up. I made a .69 on a 4.0 scale. I literally failed out of college.
Yeah.
I could say, you know, I failed out of college. And oddly enough, the biggest turkey I've ever killed in my life to date was that year. I was doing a few ornery things, but I was hunting and fishing. I've never caught more white bass in the spring than that spring, and I've never killed a bigger turkey because that's all I was doing. And,
sure.
And knew I had to change my life around, so got back in school and really applied myself. College is so easy if you try just a little bit. And, you know, getting those upper-level classes and learning more. And I actually had a minor in computer science. That was just coming on at time, just going out of cards and into monitors. So my first job was writing COBOL code. And I knew that was not for me. I still loved the logic and computers and code, but I was in an office wearing a tie, you know. My buddies are, there was no such thing as texting, but call you, collect every now and then, tell you they got a deer or whatever. And I quit and I went back. I'd worked in school as a volunteer for the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, out in Nevada, working with mule deer habitat. And I called my boss up while I was a computer programmer in St. Louis and said, hey, man, I'm not too happy here. You got a temporary job or anything? And I quit a high-paying job as a computer programmer and went and worked for minimum wage shocking trout in mountain streams.
Yeah.
And my boss said to me, you know, Grant, these temporary positions aren't going to last forever. You got to do something. So I got in grad school. And I think one of the big turning points, again, my life's been blessed. A lot of things have fell in place. I was given a seminar for a local Safari Club International chapter. They'd called the school and say, hey, we need just someone to talk about wildlife. We're having a fundraiser. So they sent me because they knew I liked deer. And I was nervous. You know, there's a bunch of wealthy people in there talking about big game. I've never even seen some pictures of the critters they were talking about, you know. And I sat down after getting my little 35-millimeter slideshow, and a little kid come up to me actually and said, hey, my dad wants to talk to you in the hall. And I thought I'd said something wrong or something. Yeah. You know? So I got in the hall, I'm nervous. And that was Mr. Bill Goodson. Bill is a guy that patented the first trail camera.
Wow.
They're nothing like we know now. But at the time, it was like, you know, amazing technology. They were giant, big, and crude, and ran off film. You had 36 pictures, and that's it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what led to me doing a master's degree on scrape behavior. We finally had a way to monitor who, when, and where, you know, what's using scrapes, and figured out that does and button bucks use scrapes probably more than bucks do and all this stuff, and published that thesis as part of my master's due to Mr. Goodson allowing me to have this technology that just wasn't present before then.
Right.
The people that had done scrape research before then had been at university studying deer and pins, which kind of biased it a little bit. And that led to a PhD, and in my PhD, again, just how God worked in my life, my professor made the dean mad and got put on the football parking lot committee. And I can remember thinking, any freshman in the engineering program at Clemson, has a great engineering school, knows more about traffic flow than a wildlife biologist. We don't know anything about traffic flow.
Yeah.
And some timber companies had been calling up wanting to improve the habitat on their land so they could charge a quarter more per acre to lease it or something. Professors didn't want to deal with it, so then again, the student gets sent out there. And that's really what kicked off my career. Hey, I thought I would do that for a year or two, have a bunch of fun, and go back to teaching at college. And that's been 35 years ago last June, and I haven't looked back. I just continued helping people with habitat and deer management.
35 years you've been, you know, deer have been a huge part of your life. Is there a mentor early on that you looked at and that you looked up to, or that kind of showed you the way, or has it been self-discovery?
Had great mentors from the science side, Dr. Larry Marston, Dr. Carl Miller, just pillars in the deer world, Dr. Harry Jackson at Mississippi State. Those guys all took time to explain and walk with me through that journey of learning, in-depth learning about deer. But my dad was a self-employed contractor, one house at a time, getting poor family. And so being self-employed, not having insurance, not knowing where your next paycheck comes from, that was just part of my life growing up.
Sure.
So stepping out on my own and working for timber companies and then private landowners and some government agencies along the way, universities, that was thrilling. That was not scary for me. That was thrilling.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of driving the state truck or the state's computer, getting your own, that's just how I was raised. So it was just, again, my life was just laid out for me to follow this path.
Yeah.
And now there, I mean, I have no idea, hundreds or thousands of consulting biologists, but there were not many. I don't know if there are any, but not many when I started. So it was kind of your own path.
Yeah. And that was in the 80s?
Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was 35
years ago.
35. Yeah. It's crazy. And back then, and that's about when I started getting into bow hunting. I was, 85, 86, 87, 87, 88, actually, in Michigan. We could hunt when we were 12. It was the first time you could bow hunt.
Yeah.
But the information about deer back then was very few and far between. There was really no TV shows. You know, there's a handful of magazines, but they weren't, they were more about the story and not as much about, you know, the habitat or deer itself. I feel like the world was still learning a lot more about deer. What is the one thing that you've seen in whitetail behavior that hunters kind of still get wrong? They think maybe it's a myth or it's something that they get wrong about the whitetail deer.
Man, there are several myths, and I was taught them too, right? My family, I followed that same trail, and getting great mentors or experience showed me some differences. I'll tell you a funny on that. So a lot of people still believe the moon impacts, some aspect of the moon impacts how deer behave or when they behave. That's absolutely not true. There's, as we're talking right now, hundreds of deer throughout the whitetails range fitted with a GPS collar. That's been going on for over a decade now. There's millions and millions of data points. So people won't argue this, but it's inarguable. The moon is not impacting what deer do. Yeah. As a matter of fact, again, as a funny, before GPS collars were really affordable, I had all this observation data from several people at university and did a lot of regression and advanced statistics and thought I could detect with some, not 100% accurate, but some actually a trend, let's say, of certain aspects of the moon. It's not just phase, everyone gets hung on that, but degrees north and south the equator, and the moon has a very elliptical orbit, so it could be 100,000 miles further from the Earth than the next cycle around.
Sure.
So there's a lot of things going on there. And I'd put all that together, big old stat package, thought, oh man, I got this figured out, and got with Deer and Deer Hunting magazine way back when. And they took that data and published something called the DAI, Deer Activity Index. And gosh, it was selling pretty good. I was making, you know, 10 or 20,000 as a graduate student, which was slamming it, man. I mean, paying my rent and getting a new Winchester at the same time, you know. I mean, I was slamming it.
Yeah.
And doggone GPS collars come out and started getting that data in, realized I had no idea what I was talking about, was not accurate at all, actually had to pull it off the market. It was very embarrassing. And that's why I think as we learn more, I encourage people to do two things. Follow the good science. Good science is repeatable, replicated, maybe multiple universities come to the same conclusion or something like that. And the second thing, and I preach this all the time, is don't think like a human when you're being a deer hunter. Think like a deer. So deer are in war zones every day. Everything wants a venison sandwich. And their motives for moving and what they do are really nothing like a human. Mm-hmm. So the big old buck doesn't run to Hoe County trying to tend all the does. That's humans putting man thoughts on a deer.
Yeah.
Actually, as they get older and older, they tend to have a smaller and smaller home range because they've learned where the dangers are.
Sure.
So thinking like a deer is probably the number one tip I can give people if they implement that, where they could put more venison in their freezer.
Yeah. So, all right. So, and those all make a lot of sense. And I remember, I mean, there still are people that swear by the moon calendar and all this stuff. And I've never, not because one way or the other, I just never followed that. When I deer hunted, for some reason, it didn't really matter to me. Cause I was more in tune, I guess, with the properties I hunted and I had an understanding of when the activity was at its peak just by being there. But
sure.
So a guy right now, it's late October, Halloween's sneaking up here. Where are you going to be on your property right now? What stands are you going to be hunting? What are you focusing on?
Yeah. So throughout most of the whitetails range, you know, take out South Alabama, South Texas, whatever, South Florida, it's the pre-rut. And let's define the pre-rut from when the first doe becomes receptive, gets a little scent in the air, to about 25% of them. Over 25%, let's call that the rut. There's so much scent in the air, bucks are not on any pattern. They're willy-nilly going everywhere, just following their nose. So we're so pre-rut right now, and we know, again, from GPS collars that bucks literally take more steps per day. That doesn't mean they go way out of their home range. They're probably taking more steps within their home range. Mm-hmm. So I want to be in travel corridors, right? They're going to be going from point A to point B to point C, downwind of bedding areas, look for does, whatever. And the place where they're going to crisscross the most is going to be at a pinch point or a travel area or a saddle on the ridge. These all have different terms depending on where you hunt and the habitat you hunt. And then another thing is where you find the most sign. When I was young, I certainly wanted to hunt a deer. Man, look at all these tracks or scat or whatever. Where you find the most sign is probably where deer feel really secure. Mm-hmm. And if you're bow hunting, you can't be there within 30 yards of them because they're going to bust you.
Yeah.
Bow hunters want to be where they're right on the edge of getting busted and the deer's are on the edge of feeling secure. That's a very, very good stand. So for me, I'm going to be in those travel corridors where the wind conditions, my approach, whatever, allow me to hunt without being busted. And if I put my time in there, I will most likely tag a buck. Chasing the exact point is tough because bucks are moving so many steps. And if this doe becomes receptive, all the movement shifts over here or over here. So
sure.
Pinch points are the magic right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's honestly, the pre-rut is probably my favorite time to be in the woods when they're, you know, on those scrapes and, you know, they're a little more predictable, I think, than, you know, yeah. rut. Obviously there's no, you know, predictability when they're kind of running around to the, you know, scent in the wind. But when it comes down to it, how important, you got to have the deer, but building habitat brings the deer to you. What is the most important thing on a property when it comes to habitat, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's always in context, right? If all your neighbors are soybean farmers or alfalfa farmers, whatever, then adding more protein is probably not going to help you much. You probably will pressure your small source of protein more than the big ag field. So I like to, you know, deer need food, cover, water daily. I want to look at about a mile out in every direction and see what's the most limited resource and make sure I have that limited resource where I'm hunting. So the solid answer is whatever's the most limited critical resource for deer in your neighborhood, you want to make sure you have that where you're hunting. And that's where we start on any property. Again, it may not be food, or it may, if you're in heavy crop years, it may be food and food plots for the mid and late season because mm-hmm. they're in those big ag fields early season. If you're down here, I live in the Ozark Mountains, you know, it's hickory nuts and rocks. Food's critical year round. Yeah. You put a food plot, unless you overpressure it, deer are coming. So in context of where you hunt, figure out what's the most limited resource and work to improve or provide that there.
Yeah. And you talk about, you know, balancing herd health with habitat. What's the biggest challenge that most landowners have when it comes to trying to do both?
Yeah. So if you want to grow healthy deer, each deer needs enough groceries year round. Deer eat about 5 pounds a day, dry weight. They're going to respirate, urinate, salivate out the moisture. So in the summer, early fall, green plants are about 70% water. So they need to eat about 17 pounds of forage a day to get 5 pounds of goody. And this is a fun trick you can do with grad students. Go pick me 17 pounds of leaves only from plants that deer like to eat. They can barely get that done in a day. And yeah. You know, that's a 100-pound doe, 5 pounds a day. She has to do that every day. 200-pound buck, twice that.
Yeah.
So having enough food, and then we use doe harvest to balance that, right? Bucks don't make more deer. So managing deer on the doe side, so I think a lot of landowners struggle to really harvest enough does
yeah.
to if they're wanting to improve the herd health. And then realizing that this is for all of us. I'm blessed to have 900 acres, and I share, I think, all the bucks here with my neighbors. I mean, deer just rarely have a home range that centers right in a property. You know, they're right. over here and they're off, and they're over here and they're off. So realizing you're sharing deer, and that should be an impetus to work even harder to provide that critical resource. And everyone wants to go to food, but cover's where deer spend their daylight hours. Mm-hmm. I want the deer on my land during daylight, so don't neglect cover. They can go feed on the neighbors at night and probably come back and still be, you know, surviving. But if they have to go get cover on the neighbors, they may be in your neighbor's freezer, not your freezer.
Yeah, that happens a lot. That happens a lot. So in your opinion, is there a perfect buck to doe ratio? Does it matter based
yeah.
Is it geography related or is it just a general number?
No, that's a biology. You know, key deer, Canadian deer, they all share the same biology. So fawns come out 1-to-1. We've literally collected thousands of fetuses late season does harvested by hunters, pulled a fetus out for research. Matter of fact, just my staff moved a bit. There's a fetal scale, so when you and your wife are expecting a child, you go to the doctor, they take an ultrasound and measure crown to rump and say, hey, your baby's going to be born X. Well, does don't lay still for ultrasound, so we take late hunter-harvested does, remove the fetuses, and measure crown to rump on a specific ruler that's in days of development, and backdate to point of conception. That's how we know exactly when the rut was in a certain area. And look at that, and that will determine when, in most states, when hunting season is, and you know, limits and stuff like that. If we think about that, like we are in Michigan, especially northern Michigan, if that fawn is born too early, it's going to drop in the snow and not have a chance of survival. It never gets out the gate.
That's right.
Or way too late, it's not big enough to survive. It doesn't gain enough weight during summer to survive that winter. So 50-50 is where fetuses come out. The most skewed I've ever measured a herd is 48 to 52.
Mm, that's crazy.
It's just nature does not build it anything but 50-50.
Yeah.
And then we start chasing antlers, and that sex, the adult sex ratio, not the whole herd, but the adult sex ratio gets really skewed, usually towards more does than bucks.
Yeah.
So you want 50-50 is where deer herds work really well. They gain weight well. They grow bigger antlers. If you have it too far skewed, the bucks are trying to tend so many does, they're losing weight, they're getting killed, fighting, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Is there a technology that's changed? I mean, I know there is. We talked about it a little before. But what's in the last 5 years, what's the biggest technology improvement that's changed the way that you do your job?
Well, thermal drones are certainly one. For preseason determining how many deer in an area that doesn't have a real closed canopy forest, thermal drones are amazing.
Yeah.
To count deer in cropland places, again, we don't have a tall closed canopy forest. Postseason, when the leaves are off, thermal drones will let you really understand how many deer survived the hunting season. Cameras are so good, you can get that accurate buck doe sex ratio.
Yeah.
You probably see the buttons on button buck fawns at that time.
Yeah.
It's an amazing technology.
Yeah.
We don't have a thermal drone. We've had some contractors do some partnership work with us on that, and just standing there watching the monitor while they're flying and, you know, seeing bobcats, how many predators on the property. There's a lot besides deer, right? Thermal drones give us a view we just did not have before. It's almost like GPS collars that today, a lot of people don't understand, the old radio telemetry weren't that accurate. You had to be here and here and triangulate to the deer.
Yep.
Well, usually most schools only had the money for one antenna, so you would take an angle here, drive over here. The deer moved X distance, but that wasn't in your calculus, you know. So those home range sizes were best guesses back in the day. They're pretty accurate now.
Yeah, no, the thermal drone technology is super fascinating. And I think I've seen it done a couple times. In certain states, it's legal to track with thermal drones, which I think is great. Yeah. I mean, other states, it's not. But the what you see, the deer in their natural habitat, it's just wild. To, like you said, the predators, where they are during the day, where they are in the evenings, it's wild to see that with your own eyes, because it's kind of like when you're sitting up on stand and during the rut, you're like, man, I wish if this woods could disappear and I could see where all the deer are from my stand right now, I'd love to know where they're at. Well, you actually do with those thermal drones. So is there something that you've seen that's kind of shocked you? Like, wow, you know, I kind of figured that, but that's really pretty cool.
There was a drone guy flying here preseason a couple years ago, and it ended up being a rainy day. You know, we put a date on calendar, shows up, it's raining. I thought, well, boy, this isn't going to work. But he was able to fly right through it, and I thought, well, all the deer are going to be bedded under cedar trees because of this rain. And I think out of the 40-plus deer he saw on that flight, one or two was under cedar. The rest are out in the open, like they got a raincoat on or something. And again, I was thinking like a human instead of a deer, right?
Yeah.
Deer live out there all the time. Rain doesn't change, you know, that's not a big deal for them. The rest of us are under a raincoat by the truck trying to watch the guys monitor, you know? So that, again, that thermal drone gives us a broad view all at once. GPS collars give us a microscopic view of one deer, but you don't know what else is happening out there.
Yeah.
Combining both those technologies allows us to learn a lot more. And I want to say one other thing if I could right there. So there's a lot of crying about whatever, thermal drones or coyote hunting at night or any of these things. And all tools, the internet, which we're using now, all tools can be used for good or bad. It's up to us to have the character to use those for good. All tools can be used for good or bad.
That's right. Totally agree with that comment. I think there's a lot of people that have comments about thermal drone technology. And if, in my opinion, if you can use it, you should be able to use it in every state to track a wounded deer, in my opinion. I know there's a lot of conversation around that. I don't want to get too deep into that, but any way that you can increase
not waste a resource.
100%. Yeah, 100%. And that's my thought on it.
Me too.
I do want to talk about the proving grounds. Now this is now you've got proving grounds and proving grounds two now, right? You've got go through that. Talk about
my wife and I. Yeah, my wife and I had I've lived this blessed life. We were young, married, didn't have much money, and looking for land, couldn't afford much. You can never afford as much as you want at any stage of life, right?
Right.
And we found this piece of property a hospital had owned. A guy died, left it to a hospital, and they had sold it, but the deal didn't close, and apparently the hospital needs some money, so we bought it for a dime on dollar type deal. Worked there 20 years and just poured our savings and heart and soul and calluses into it, and it was pretty nice. And a gentleman from Texas wanted it more than we did. And the back 900 acres, over time, we'd acquired, neighbors sold 60 acres here and whatever, 40 here. And we'd added 900 acres to the back over a 20-year period of time.
Yeah.
And when that gentleman made that offer, I said to my wife, I hadn't done much to it. I didn't have the budget to work on it. It was a 4-mile tractor ride to get to it, all that stuff. Yeah. So it was just kind of raw. And I said, honey, I'd like a new project. I think I can make this land better so much quicker because I've learned so much over the last 20 years than I did the first go around. Mm-hmm. And you get a new house out of deal. So that's how my wife Tracy and I got here. She's getting a new house and I got a new project. And so now this is 900 acres. It actually shares a border with the Proven Grounds 1 for about a mile. And it's rough and rocky, but we are making progress much faster. I know what works in this habitat and what doesn't work and what the deer respond to. And I'm really enjoy so much watching habitat improve and the critters, all critters, not just deer, respond to that. Like, I'll tell you, we got a really good turkey population now. That's not true throughout a lot of the turkeys' range. We remove a lot of predators. We focus on that nesting, brooding habitat, which overlaps a lot with deer habitat. And it's critters respond really quickly. And the flip side, ticks are a big issue for human health and deer health throughout the whitetails range. I'm a nerd. I read a lot. I like to read the old journals of trappers. A lot of people think of Lewis and Clark. If you read the actual Lewis and Clark journal, not the movie or something, they went from St. Louis to the Pacific Ocean, and one day they talk about ticks. Mm. And they were walking, folks. They weren't going down I-80.
Yeah.
You can't walk out in your yard here in the Ozarks now and not talk about ticks.
Right.
So the forest canopy's closed in. We're not using fire like the Native Americans did. And when we restore that native habitat, all creatures respond positively or negatively to the quality of the habitat. When you open up the canopy and dry out down there, ticks don't do too well. So I am learning those lessons that I'm sure predecessors have learned, but it's fun to learn it on your own land and see it and restore that native habitat.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot more of that happening, and I think I love to see it. There's a group down in South Dakota called Second Century Habitat, and a buddy of mine is kind of working with them. But they're all about, on farms there's a lot of dead area that's either gets wet year over year and they just don't grow on it. It's corners, a lot of times it's corners of fields, and they're taking that back to what it used to be, natural grasses and or native grasses, and it's become a really great project in you know, I think more of that thought process needs to happen. Even up here in Michigan, we used to have pheasants like crazy. But farmers are going all the way to the fences now. There's no, you know, there's not 10 yards of CRP or grasses in between fence rows now. You know, they're tight and they're going to the timber lines and going to the ditches. And, you know, a lot of that habitat for upland birds and everything's gone. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And I like that, you know, the native, going back to the native grasses and stuff like that, I think if you have the ability to do that, I think you'll see improvement in everything. In your, you know, wildlife all over your property. Stay tuned for part two of this week's conversation. But first, after the break, we'll dive into everything ammunition on our weekly Ammo 101 segment. This portion of the Winchester Life Podcast has been brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, a world leader in delivering innovative products. Winchester is the American legend, a brand built on integrity, hard work, and a deep focus on its loyal customers. Considered one of the world's leading ammunition manufacturers, Winchester has built its reputation on delivering innovative ammunition products, providing top-shelf customer service, and demonstrating industry leadership. To learn more, visit Winchester.com. Winchester Optics. The Winchester Supreme line of optics offers rifle scopes, binoculars, spotting scopes, and rangefinders for all of your shooting and hunting needs. To learn more, visit worldofwinchester.com. Winchester Repeating Arms. The guns that work with a reputation built on reliability. Winchester rifles and shotguns are built tough with superior fit and finish. Winchester firearms are built to exceed expectations. To learn more, visit winchesterrepeatingarms.com. This week in our Ammo 101 segment, we got Ben Frank from Winchester Ammunition in-house, and we're going to talk about a product that's been 10 years since it's been developed, which is crazy. 10-year anniversary, Deer Season XP.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday, Deer Season XP. I remember when we started dreaming up the concept of the launch, and we really wanted to lean into the deer season, the traditions of deer season. And, you know, that film was probably still one of my most favorite projects we ever did. But there was a real true reason behind the development of Deer Season XP. It wasn't just a marketing thing. It was different than that. What is the reason in the beginning, like when you guys thought about Deer Season XP creating that cartridge, what was it?
Yeah, I mean, you think about, for us at least up until that point, and really I think anyone else out there who was building bullets at the time, mm-hmm. you were building bullets to use for a lot of different things. So like we had PowerPoint, we had ballistic silver tip, we had some other bullets throughout time. And a lot of times those bullets were either, they could be used for deer, they could be used for big game.
Yeah.
Nothing was really purpose built around whitetail.
Right.
And it's like you said, it's kind of surprising that it never happened before, yeah. but it's like, that is the most popular game animal that anyone in this country chases. And it's like, well, let's build something that is going to dump a ton of energy, it's going to be super accurate, and it's going to be perfect for whitetail deer.
Yeah.
And that's where Deer Season XP came from.
What's some of the things in the design that you guys created that made it maybe different than a PowerPoint?
Yeah, so first off, it's a polymer tip bullet, and it's a polymer tip bullet that is arguably the most affordable polymer tip bullet that you can find today mm-hmm. still.
Yeah.
And that was our goal as well, is when we build this thing, it's like we know whitetail hunters, they're also are cost conscious, and so we want to be able to provide them with this technology at an affordable price. And that extreme point tip, so that polymer tip, there'd really never been anything like it with a large polymer tip like that. And that large impact diameter really is where the catalyst of dumping that energy on a whitetail, which is like a lot of times some of those bullets, they may get more penetration, they may pass through, some of that energy is really being lost by yeah. going through that animal.
That's right.
And we're like, how can we put as much of this energy on there so it take these animals down quickly? So where you're at the time, it was like we're measuring these tracking them in feet, not yards kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it was, and that's really what happens with deer season. I mean, there's so many times where you'll shoot deer with them and they're just, I mean, dead right there.
Yeah. So I guess 10 years later, when you guys look back, has it done what you wanted it to do? I mean, this is, I think, is a staple in anybody's backpack during, you know, rifle season as a nutty bar or a Swiss cake roll. Like, this is the tried and true. When you look back, though, are you guys proud about the product?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually think before we even started talking about it, like, this is probably one of the most successful launches and successful products that we have had in the last 10 years, maybe, you know, in our history, because it's done so well for us. It continues to grow. I mean, we have it in virtually all the major calibers and then some, and we continue to grow it out into some of the more smaller volume calibers. And we're actually started, you know, the original story for Winchester was, let's, you know, and for Deer Season XP was, let's build a bullet that is the exact weight that you need for deer. I mean, this is all you need. You know, you need 150 grain bullet to kill a whitetail and a 30 cal, and that still holds true to this day.
Yep.
But we also know that sometimes people want a different mousetrap. Maybe they want a little bit more energy, maybe even a little more penetration. So now we've actually added some heavier bullets to Deer Season XP. So we have 180 grain bullets there. We've added some heavier 6.5 Creedmoor bullets. So we continue to add to that line because it's, again, it's so successful and it just works so well.
What's the most recent addition that you guys have had?
I'd say those heavy bullets are very recent, and then additionally is the 400 Legend. So
yeah, true.
Anytime we were coming out with these new cartridges like 350 and 400, Deer Season is, you know, one of the first things that we want to build specifically for those two as well, because they are Midwestern cartridges that are designed. The cartridge itself is designed around deer hunting. So yeah, we're very proud of Deer Season XP. 10 years, I mean, it feels like a lot shorter time, but then again, when you think about the amount of bullets and the amount of products and all the different cartridges and calibers that they've built with Deer Season,
it's
pretty incredible. I mean, we talk about how PowerPoint historically has been like, hey, you can take every product we've ever built and there's probably not been, you know, you can add them all up and you're still not going to equal PowerPoint.
Right.
Deer Season's starting to creep up on it because it's that popular.
Yeah. And it's just that good. Yeah. It's just that good. The results are crazy. When you put a polymer tip on a 350 or 400 Legend bullet, it's not only a straight wall, but it's got that, you know, same technology woven in. It's, you just can't miss.
Yeah. Yep. And you know, the last thing for me really is the accuracy of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, a lot of times that kind of gets lost in the shuffle of us talking about how well it performs on game, but you got to get there, right? And you got to put it on target. And Deer Season has consistently been one of the most, if not the most accurate bullet we build today. And we're very proud of that as well, because, you know, as a deer hunter myself, it's a lot of fun to be able to go out and sight in my rifle and know exactly where I'm hitting. And Deer Season does that for you.
Yeah. So. 10 years, man. Deer Season XP, happy birthday. Coming up next on the Winchester Life podcast is part two of our guest conversation. But first, a few words from our partners. Nylo, the prestigious Winchester Hunting and Shooting Sports Facility, is now an Orvis-endorsed hunting grounds. Over the course of more than 160 years, Orvis has built a brand synonymous with quality, integrity, and the finest service standards in the industry. This recognition ensures that visitors of an Orvis-endorsed operation encounter unparalleled service, respect for natural resources, and an experienced professional staff. Located in Brighton, Illinois, Nylo was founded by John M. Olin in 1952 as an ideal model of conservation. Nylo is dedicated to unsurpassed upland hunting, sport shooting, and some of the finest hunting dogs in the country. Over time, Nylo has filled its guest books with distinguished names and hosted shooting sports competitions and events, benefiting various national and local charities. For more information and to book your shooting sports or hunting experience, visit nylofarms.com.
And now, back to the show. Growing Deer TV, now talk about that. When did you guys start that?
We're going on 16 years.
Wow.
And there was again, no grand plan. I didn't sit down with my yellow pad and a pencil one day, say, boy, I'm going to start this. Internet's coming on, blah, blah, blah. Yep. I was traveling as a consulting biologist. I still do, but I was traveling a lot. And I had young children, and I missed a flight out of Philly. It was a winter snowstorm. And so, you've done this a bunch. You get late over in the airport, you're too tight, get a hotel, and you drag in about 11 o'clock the next morning. You're wore out. And my daughter wants to play ball, and they were real young. So at that age, you sit on the floor, and you split your legs out so the ball didn't get away from you and roll it back and forth.
Yep.
And the phone rang. And as soon as the phone rang, she said, Daddy. Because that's how she knew me. I was traveling to make a living for my family.
Yep.
And I said, oh, man,
yeah,
that's got to change. I'm very family-oriented. I may have to go back and teach at a university or something like that. And my good friend Bill Winky had just started Midwest Whitetail. Mm-hmm. And Bill and I have been buddies forever. And he's like, hey, why don't you kind of be our token biologist or whatever? And I talked to Bill. See, I think if I'm going to do that, I'd rather just do it on deer biology and helping hunters understand deer biology and habitat. So that's how it started. It was that simple, a way to stay home. I did not realize that growing deer would expand the us helping landowners so much just because of the presence.
Sure.
You might call it marketing, although we don't ever market it. It's just people see you doing it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we started, had no idea what we were doing. No idea.
Yeah.
Never been behind a camera. I've been in front of it a few times, never behind it. And we were blessed, and it grew at a time when there wasn't much competition.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't have had the trajectory now if we started right now that we had then. And so we're just about to cross 500,000, half million followers on YouTube and 1 million on Facebook. So pretty decent numbers.
Oh, great numbers. Great numbers.
And that's just, we just try to provide information that can help. We want to help people.
Yeah.
We don't have flash.
No ego.
And I'm not good looking. Yep. It's just information.
Yeah. So when you get into that world, you, whether you like it or not, you're a storyteller, but you're also, a scientist in a lot of ways. So in a storyteller and a scientist, how do you balance that? Was there a learning curve to telling these stories or, to see 16 years ago where you were and where you are now, like, what was that path like?
Again, things I've said this so many times, but been blessed, things fell in place. I was on an elk hunt on private land in New Mexico. And when I'm in hunting camp, man, I'm a serious hunter. Like I hunt, I eat, I sleep. I hunt, I eat, I sleep. I don't stay up all night and party and stuff. And there was a cameraman for another guy in camp named Blake Porter, who was a very, very famous cameraman at that time. And he was the same way. So we kind of sat at the end of this big table. It was an outdoor rider hunt. And we were down at the end. Did you hear any bugles? Are they going to water? What's going on? And everyone else was staying up late. As soon as that conversation, we're going to bed. And when this happened, this incident with my daughter, I called up Blake, said, hey, I'm going to start this thing on YouTube. He's like, man, the internet's never going anywhere. That won't work. I said, well, you told me you're tired of traveling, filming hunts. What if you produce growing deer? I just film and send you footage. Blake is in Wisconsin, and we're try it. And I said, I'll pay you whatever you're making now. Just give me a year. Let's try the year, see what happens. Yeah. So that's how we started. And Blake was a tremendous guide to me. And then my grandfather was not a worker. I'll say this nicely, not a worker. Tremendously skilled hunter and fisherman. And a big-time storyteller.
Yeah.
Big time. I still remember his stories. And my dad, I lost my dad a few years ago. He was my best friend. Couldn't read. He didn't learn to read till he was 60. Literally did not learn to read till he was 60. But he was a tremendous custom home builder. Everyone wanted Glenn Woods to build them a house in our little community.
Yeah.
And so starting about fifth grade, two things happened that led to my career. Microwave ovens come out. And they changed the way sliding glass doors worked. And my dad could not read the instructions to install these things. So I would get out of school to go read those instructions and put it in terms. And I do not mean this to be, anyone knows me, my dad and I were super close. So dad could understand these and put these new things that people want in their houses. Yeah. So I was trained at an early age to take technical information and break it down in a way that people could understand it. And that's what I do now. And my dad gave me the opportunity to work on that craft early on.
Yeah, that's wild. So when you've said hunting is it, obviously it's not just about the harvest, but it means so much more. What does it personally mean to you when it all comes together and you made that perfect shot, you have your hands on that deer, maybe you've got history of that deer, or maybe you're with your kid, grandkids, or whoever that might be. What's it mean to you to have that story complete right there in front of you?
I think for me, hunting, working to provide life, taking life, providing meat for your family, we're really into the venison or whatever game we harvest, is a true reflection of life. There are many things to do this, but hunting or planting a food plot, you put something looks like a dead item, a seed in the ground, and it comes to life and provides bounty for other critters to benefit on. All these things, I think, are reflections of how we should live life. And to the point, my oldest daughter, who now works for SpaceX, obviously very technical, her name is Raleigh. That's Old English for dweller by the deer meadow. Mm. My youngest daughter is Ray, R-A-E, works for a very high-end defense company, kind of secretive, making drones. R-A-E, Ray, is Hebrew for doe. That's how much deer impact everything in my family.
Oh, yeah.
And my children grew up hunting with me and turkey hunting with me, and we process the meat, we provide the meat. And I want to share this just really recently, short story. We did some work with Dr. Stefan Van Bleet. He's one of the world's leading human nutritionists. And he had published that wild-caught salmon's the healthiest meat we can put in our body. Humans can survive on nothing but wild-caught salmon. I said, man, you know, whitetails, they got a really thin muzzle. They're very selective feeders, where an elk's a grass feeder, a cow, bison, big old muzzle, just shovel it in, they're turning into protein.
Yeah.
So I sent him samples of 17 loins and 17 livers from deer we harvested. Turns out some of the healthiest meat on the planet. Mm. So as hunters, as whitetail hunters, harvesting specifically whitetail deer, elk is great, but they eat grass. They don't eat all the forbs deer eat.
Right.
That's literally providing some of the healthiest meat you can provide your family. All of the phytonutrients and flavonoids, and this is getting deep into science, that you're not going to get, no chance you can get out of a corn, fat, and beef. It just doesn't exist in corn, fat, and beef. So I think all hunters, I'm old enough, I remember when, I think maybe it was Outdoor Life something, if you killed a 10-point buck, no matter what the 10-point was, you get a little sticker on your sleeve, you know.
Yep.
We almost need a sticker that says, you know, I provided 50 pounds of venison for my family. Yeah. I killed two. I provided 100 pounds of quality venison for my family.
Yeah, I love that. You should start it.
I think where we are in the hunting world, we've come so far around. We've went past center.
Yeah.
That we got to get back to hunting is fun, and we are ultimately big rack, no rack.
Yep.
We are providing some of the best meat. We're providers.
Yeah.
Which should be a badge of honor. We are providing, in an honorable way, some of the best meat, organic, wholesome meat our family can consume.
Yeah.
And that may ultimately, that plus the experience with your family and friends, may be the biggest trophy of the hunt.
100%. I don't know if it's just me, and I don't think it's just me. I kind of feel it. I feel like that circle's coming back to the more simplicity part, the simpler days. Like, I don't know if it's just my era. You're a little older than me, but we've been in the industry. We've seen it all. We've seen it just all about finding a tree stand, like when tree stands were made. Like, I'm in a tree stand now, to all the way to trail cameras. And I had a trail camera that was film, and I had it set on a tree over a scrape. And I went back 2 days later, and the 36, I got a big old roll, 36 blew through them. I was like, heck yeah. I go to get it developed, and it's 36 pictures of a branch moving. And I thought for sure I was going to be all a bunch of bucks. But, you know, then it's come to digital trail cameras and then all this technology. And then the score was the thing. And it was, you know, but I really truly feel like I see less people throwing scores out there now. I see more people talking about the story and more people talking about, you know, providing meat and venison for your family or for other people. So I really do feel like it's swinging back a little bit. And I think it's probably because there's an overload of information. You know, there were three or four, you know, television networks dedicated to hunting, and it was just in your face all the time. And I think people are now, I feel like, trying to simplify, even though the technology is there for you to get all the information and to have the good bows and to have the great optics. And but I do feel like there's a simpler mindset happening across the country. And I don't know if it's just me or if you feel that too, but I do feel like we're swinging back.
Absolutely. I worked recently for a lady in Pennsylvania that, you know, we never knew who's calling, and we just go help people with their land and her goals. And she had 40 acres of Pennsylvania. She's a very successful software engineer. And she wanted to eat better, and she realized she had deer eating all her pansies and azaleas and everything around her house on her 40 acres. And so she had us come up and develop a plan and teach her also about hunting, because she just wanted to meet. Four legs, mm-hmm. you know, big ears, it was qualifying.
Yeah.
What's on top of the head didn't matter to her.
Yeah.
And that was such an enjoyable experience for me, because she was just so hungry to learn.
Yeah.
She didn't have preconceived notions, and she wanted to meet. That was her trophy. That was her reason for getting out of bed.
Yeah.
And it's all good, right? I love big antlers. I love big
sure.
antlers.
Absolutely.
I love people send me trail camera pictures. I like it all.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, man, just that experience with your family or loved ones or whoever, and hey, I'm going to go to this oak tree. You're going down by the pond. I'll see you at lunch. We're going to share a bologna sandwich on the back of the truck.
Yep.
That's real hunting there.
That's real hunting. And I feel like in the big explosion of deer hunting in the mid to late 90s, in the early 2000s, I feel like a lot of those guys that are my age were in college or just getting, and there were some of the biggest waivers of the inch flag. You know, I got a 130.
Yeah.
You got to pass that deer. And, you know, I feel like now they all have kids and they're not part of that. You know, it's not new anymore. And I feel like there's definitely more of a focus on passing it down than there was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, which is a good thing, in my opinion.
There's a lot of published research on the stages of a hunter, and I think to put some boundaries on what you're saying is, you know, first you just want to see a deer, and you want to get a deer, then you want to get a bunch of deer, fish, whatever you're doing. Then you want to get a big one, and you want to get a sure enough trophy. Then you want to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And guys, you're in my age, you're maturing. Hopefully we're maturing to that enjoyment stage. I still want to harvest deer. I still get a thrill of big antlers.
Absolutely.
All those things. But I want to enjoy it and pass it on to other people.
Amen to that. Amen. So 10 years you've worked with Winchester, or more roughly. Do you remember how that partnership began?
I do. I have a really good friend, CJ Davis, was doing some marketing for Winchester at the time, and he introduced me to Jason, and we just kind of hit it off and went from there. So I owe that great relationship to CJ, and they've just been awesome. I had a text earlier this week from Jason. I think what I like there is their values are very similar to what we just talked about.
Yeah.
And it's been a very credible, great company for us to share with and do stuff with. Man, that's been fun.
Yeah.
I hope that continues, because that's fun.
Yeah, the values do line up. And what you like to see, and what I like to see about Winchester, is the same people have been there. You know, we're going on 15 or more years of doing stuff with Winchester. Man, the same people are still there. You know, you're still working with the same people, but they treat you like family. It's more than just a job to a lot of the people. Most of the people we've talked to, it's more than a job. Even when they're on the floor, you know, building the ammunition, there's something about that family type style, that Winchester name. I don't know. I can't put my finger on it, but It's just got such a different feel than a lot of companies that we've ever worked with.
And that umbrella's big, because, you know, when we have a team meeting and you're there seeing you or the juries or whoever you're seeing, you know, yep. There's a lot of camaraderies and not as much competition as some other circles. And I remember touring the ammo plant at Oxford, mm-hmm. and the technology there just because that's not my world. I'm a biologist, just blew me away. Yep. But what was even more than the technology was meeting the people on the line and the tremendous pride they had in what they're doing. And those American flags hanging down because they build some ammo for our military guys, the best of the best, right? And when you met those people on that line, man, they were spot on. They were doing a job that they knew had true meaning to them. Well, that's the company I want to align with.
Amen, man. Couldn't have said it better. Talking about the ammunition itself, they do make the best ammunition in the world. What is it that you think, from an engineering standpoint, from a technology standpoint, they continue to push the envelope when it comes to whitetail deer hunting loads, cartridges? What is it that you've seen over the last 10 years that they've done that's kind of, that you're impressed with?
Yeah, I think that's right off the bat, it's Deer Season XP. I mean, they took a step and designed a bullet specifically for whitetails. Of course, that's America's game animal right now. It's the number one game animal by far. And we all just shot, you know, whatever load we shot. And yes, deer were harvested for sure, but they took the time to develop a round because whitetails are relatively thin skin. Even on a big buck, you can take a whitetail rib and break it, not like a, you know, a giant grizzly bear or an elk or something like that. Yeah. So listening to hunters and being hunters, you know, Jason, all the guys there are hunters. And so, and they're calling me up, what do you think about this? And then they have their ideas, and all the testing they do is just phenomenal. They could build a bullet way less expensive than they do, but it wouldn't perform like it does. Right. And then what I really like, especially with Deer Season XP, to have a bullet at that price point that performs so well.
Yeah.
I just took a couple of does for my freezer with Deer Season XP, and it's on video, and they were what I call one-steppers.
Yeah.
They take one step. You don't have to spend all night out there looking for them or something like that. They're one-steppers. I love one-steppers.
One-steppers in there, yeah. That Deer Season XP, it's an incredible incredible technology, and it's still, it's time and time again, it's proven it is the best. It's the best ammunition for white-tailed deer in the world. What's your setup? What's your go-to when you're going out? It's opening day and you've got your rifle with you. What's your rifle ammo setup?
Yeah. For a few years now, I've been on a 6.5 Creedmoor, and I'm shooting an XPR. Man, I mean, again, that's just at a price point every deer hunter can have.
Yep.
And they're minute of angle guns, right? You're gonna shoot an inch or less. Mine's about a half inch. And I mean, I have nothing special. I went to Bass Pro, picked it up. And I slapped a scope on there myself, which means my scope literally is a little off-sided. I'm like, how did that happen? It's shooting good. I don't want to redo it, you know? When you can shoot an ammo round and, again, a Winchester XP, and you're shooting half-inch groups at 100 yards off an old cobbled-up bench I got here on the ranch, right? This isn't like the match guy shooting 1,000-yard stuff. Right. You got your coat rolled up and you're doing it.
Yeah.
To me, that just works every day.
Yeah.
I don't, again, processing over 1,000 whitetails for research, pulling blood samples, all the stuff. And if this is your game, that's great. But I don't need a big 300 Win Mag. I mean, any of the 243s, 7mm08, 6.5 Creedmoors, any in that kind of what I call mid-range calibers are awesome whitetail guns. And if you sight them in at two, I sight my guns in 2 inches high at 100 yards for whitetail. So, you know, 100 yards you're on, 200 yards you're spot on all those calibers. 300 yards you're somewhere 6-8 inches low.
Yep, covers it all.
Then that's meat for a white. That covers it all for a whitetail guy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's. I mean, growing up here in Michigan, you've got a lot of the old 30-30s, 35s. You know, the brush guns and. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the common denominator is anything inside a 300 yard. I think there's probably such a small percentage of hunters, even in Michigan anyway, that have probably shot a deer over 300 yards. It's probably 5%, you know, in our state. It really doesn't happen. But yeah, I think you've kind of got the right idea there. So when you think about Winchester in general, what's it mean to be a part of Winchester to you?
I mean, that's a big point of pride for me. I mean, it truly is the American legend. I was raised, again, there was no planning here, obviously, but, you know, my family had Winchesters. You know, Dad had that old Winchester that was just trusty, you know. And when for Christmas, usually my dad would get a box of 12-gauge and I'd get a box of 410, and Mom would go down to the old Western Auto Store. This is long before there were the big stores we have now.
Yeah.
And you knew it, right? It's wrapped in this square box and it's heavy. You knew what you were getting, and you were still excited, right? Those days are just, matter of fact, I kept, you can see it up here, I have it up here for just display, but I kept one of the old boxes.
Yeah.
I'll bring it down just so people can see it a little bit
here.
Yeah,
bring it down. Oh, yeah. Look at that. Boy,
you know,
it's
this is something
shape.
Back from. Yeah, well, I probably stole that on my dad's closet, to be honest. But, you know, that still got the original loads in it from when I was a kid.
Love it.
And I don't know how we didn't shoot it. It must have been behind a pair of shoes we never wore or something. But
that's great.
Yeah, that's what I was raised with. That was just a trusted brand. And I think that's still the same. And, again, that point of pride and knowing the work I do with our military, that's my home. I feel good about it. I feel good about the W. I feel good about the people there because I know they're not going to let me down. I feel good about the credibility. You're never hearing those old boogie stories coming out of Winchester, right? Yeah. So, and they're going to be there. You know they were there last year, 150 years ago, and they're going to be there the next 100 years.
That's
so
right.
I like that. To me, that's that American strength. It's just solid. And the backstory of how that all came to be, and the Olin family and all that, that's truly the American legend.
Right on there, buddy. Couldn't have said it better, man. Well, so real quick before we go, what do you have coming up this fall? Are you sticking around? Are you going to any other state? What's the setup?
Got a couple other states. Probably do Southern Illinois, and I have some great friends in Kentucky I like to hunt with. And next year I have an elk hunt. You know, I can't do that elk hunt every year. I would like to, but I'm kind of a deer guy, so I need to. I'm not a skilled elk hunter. I just love being in the mountains when the leaves are changing, the elk are bugling. Man, that's a treat. If you don't get to do it, treat yourself every other year, every third year, whatever, and go do that.
Yeah.
I love turkey hunting. People may not know that about me. I'm a passionate turkey hunter, man. It's so interactive.
Yes.
Hopefully you're hearing them. And that's a true chess game there. You hear them, you know where they are. That does not mean they're coming into shotgun range.
That does not.
I love that game.
It's the greatest game in the spring. There's no question about it, man. Well, Dr. Grant Woods, thank you so much for taking time and really in the middle of whitetail season to chat with us. And good luck for the rest of the year, man.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please make sure you click the follow button on your podcast apps so you never miss a new episode. This episode was produced by Aaron Cox and Jason Gilbertson, engineered by Jason Freer, directed by Chad Andrus, written and edited by Jason Brown, with behind-the-scenes photography by Kelsey Myers. I'm Jason Brown, and you've been listening to the Winchester Life Podcast. See you next time.